This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. As we all know, Benjamin Franklin was one of the most famous and well-traveled men during his lifetime, who hobnobbed with royalty and diplomats and helped to found the United States. And according to Jill Lepore, the person to whom he wrote the most letters was his youngest sister, Jane. They called each other Benny and Jenny. Lepore's new book is titled Book of Ages, The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin. These siblings' lives could not have been more different. Jane married at 15, had 12 children, lived in poverty, was saddled with debt because of her husband's business failures, and while she could read, she could barely spell. That made deciphering her journal entries and letters a challenge, and unlike her big brother, she did not leave much behind. But that did not deter Jill Lepore. Today on Radio Times, what Jane Franklin's life can tell us about the bond between Jane and Ben, and about women of her time. Jill Lepore is the David Woods Kemper 41 Professor of American History at Harvard University. She's also a staff writer at The New Yorker, and she joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. And Jill Lepore, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I'd love to have you read from the very, very beginning of your book. This is really the preface.
Sure. Benjamin Franklin's sister Jane thought of her brother as her second self. He was the youngest of 10 sons. She was the youngest of 7 daughters. Benny and Jenny, they were called when they were little. No two people in their family were more alike. Their lives could hardly have been more different. He ran away from home when he was 17. She never left. He taught himself to write with wit and force and style. She never learned how to spell. The day he turned 21, he wrote her a letter. She was 14, beginning a correspondence that would last until his death 63 years later. He became a printer, a philosopher, and a statesman. She became a wife, a mother, and a widow. He signed the Declaration of Independence, the Treaty of Paris, and the Constitution. She strained to form the letters of her name. He loved no one longer. She loved no one better. He wrote more letters to her than he wrote to anyone. All her life, she wrote back, letter after letter, filled with news and recipes and gossip, and when she was truly sorely vexed, and only then, with her blistering opinions about politics.
And that's our guest, Jill Lepore, reading from the preface to her new book about Jane Franklin. What got you interested in her? Because she's been buried by history.
Yeah, you know, what happened was one day, when I had this thing that a lot of avid readers do, that when you fall in love with someone as a writer, you desperately want to read everything they ever wrote, right? Like when you're a kid and you read Ramona the Pest, you need to read every Henry Huggins story. Like you need to read every Beverly Cleary book. So I had that from childhood. And when I was in college, I got really interested in Benjamin Franklin.
Who can blame you, right?
He's such a delightful and charming writer. Like his voice just leaps off the pages. He's funny. He's smart. It's just quite challenging in ways. It's a very sly writer. So I one day decided I would read everything that Franklin ever wrote. And this is an easy thing to do because, of course, there's a whole Benjamin Franklin industry, as nobody knows better than the inhabitants of Philadelphia.
Indeed. And you're welcome. Yes.
So I went to the library where, you know, since the 1950s, the Benjamin Franklin Papers Project has been compiling everything he ever wrote and printing it in these published volumes. And I pulled one volume after another off the shelf, like slumped down into the floor the way I would do in the library. It's like 40-something volumes. And I just kept reading day in and day out. And I was just gobsmacked. Every other letter seemed to be to this sister of his named Jane, whom I had never heard of before.
But what's interesting is that while his letters have largely remained, I'm sure many of hers, as you write, were either tossed or just those don't remain in the same kind of way as Ben Franklin's.
Yeah, so they wrote for 63 years, and for the first 60 of those years, the first 30 of those years, the only letters that survive are his letters to her.
Right.
So, you know, as a historian, that's just a disaster. Right? Like it's like trying to listen to one end of a, you know, like when you're in the subway and there's a cell phone and someone's talking into it and you can hear one end and you're like, it's just irritating. Like it boggles your mind because you're trying so hard to imagine the other end of the conversation. It's actually almost like neurologically disturbing. That's, as a historian, to read one side of a correspondence just drives you nuts.
Yeah.
But it's also so poignant. Like the thing that I really wanted to attend to is, we can't really know why her side of the correspondence doesn't last. We could speculate. For one thing, Franklin had thousands of correspondence.
Of course.
The guy wrote an enormous number of letters. You know, he's, you know, writing to kings and philosophers and scientists and has, you know, tremendous business dealings. Jane really only wrote to Benjamin. So he may just have misplaced her letters. You know, there's the, very easily, just she cherished everything he sent to her. She had very little. She had a little trunk. She put all the letters that he sent to her in them. She kept them precious and close. But it may be, too, because there was so much insanity in her family that those decades of her correspondence were destroyed, either by Franklin or by one of his early biographers, who would have had a lot of reason. People really wanted to hide insanity for all kinds of reasons that we can understand. So it may not be accidental.
Did you have to use, though, your historian and journalistic skills to create her? Because you only had sort of bits and sort of shards of her life and her personality. Even.
Yeah, it's really tricky also because even for the years when her letters do survive, they're lovely and fascinating, but still, he's Benjamin Franklin. It's like they're never on equal terms at any point. Like he's off, you know, she's like, why don't you write to me? And he's like, well, I've been a little busy. And, you know, like he's at the Constitutional Convention. Or she's like, I need some firewood. And he's like, well, I've been in Paris. You know, like it's not like writing about Franklin's correspondence with John Adams, or even like Abigail's correspondence with John Adams, like who they were educated, you know, they had similar kind of standards of education. But I'm really interested in that asymmetry because it tells us so much.
Sure.
Like we live with all kinds of inequality and huge social and political problems that face us today are basically questions about inequality. Why not, as a historian, shouldn't we actually look carefully at inequality, even in the archives, even in the survival of the historical record? What does that tell us? Not to just sort of say, oh, that's a problem, that's difficult, we can't solve that, but say, how could we solve that?
But what's interesting is how much he seemed to rely on her, I mean, how much he valued their relationship as brother and sister.
Yeah, he really, really cares about her, and it's quite a generous and loving side of Franklin, who a lot of people find him fairly mischievous and somewhat unreliable as a character, and in many ways he's a kind of duplicitous fellow, but the earnestness of his affection for her, his incredible generosity towards her and towards her children is, I think, really quite a moving thing and casts him in a new light.
Well, in fact, you quote one of his letters, "Dear sister, I've always judged by your behavior when a child that you would make a good, agreeable woman, and you know you were my particular favorite, or my peculiar favorite, I should say." Then he goes on to write, "I hear you are grown a celebrated beauty."
Yeah.
I mean, there are no pictures of
there's
her,
no,
but
there,
in his mind, perhaps, or his
Yeah,
eye.
And there's also, you know, he's a flattering fellow, and 18th century letters are like that. You'd be very coy, and you would say that, you know, she's 14 when he writes that, and he's actually writing to her to say, please watch out for your virginity. I hear you've grown very, very beautiful, and I know that you're just like me. Like, you're saucy, and you're cheeky, and you're miffy and easily irritated, and you're full of pride. And he, you know, this is Franklin, who's just really gotten back from a season of sleeping with prostitutes in London. Like, he has had a very errant youth, and he got away with it, and he knows that she wouldn't get away with that. And he knows that she is very much like him, and he also knows what that can consign her to by way of a fate. She's 14 when he writes that. He was right to worry. She marries at 15. She was probably pregnant.
You think she might have been pregnant at the time?
Well, it was illegal to marry at 15 without your parents' approval, because the legal age was 16, but the average age was 24, and all of her sisters married at around age 24. It was really weird to marry at 15, and the guy she married was very poor, so if her parents gave their approval, it was probably because she was pregnant.
And she married this guy named Edward Meekham.
Yeah, and he turned out to be not a good choice, and you see in a different way when you follow someone through the course of their life. You know, we know that in the 18th century, like, it's just like, think of a Jane Austen novel, like every woman's fate hinges on who they marry, you know, and that's why all this 18th century fiction is about the choice of a marriage in 19th century fiction, because it determines your whole, the course of your life. But, and, you know, the Austen novels all end at that moment, and the choice has been a good one. Jane's story really begins with the marriage to the guy next door who's a drunk and turns out to be a madman, and she marries him at 15, and it entails upon her a fate of poverty.
Well, you're right. He was either a bad man or a madman, but clearly they had children who had problems with mental illness, it seems.
Yeah, they had 12 kids, and some of them died in infancy of the usual and nevertheless incredibly sad childhood infant diseases that took one in four children before the age of 10. A number of her children, Jane's children, did live to adulthood, and at least two of her sons became violently insane and had to be locked up.
Wow. She could read. I mean, she didn't go to school, as we understand it, but she could read.
Yeah, so it was a requirement. I mean, New England, 18th century New England was a really literate place because it's this Puritan commonwealth. And it's, you know, the sort of the chief act of the Reformation, like the pinnacle of the Reformation. Everybody must learn to read in order to read the Bible and therefore be saved. So it was a requirement. It was a law. All girls and boys need to learn to read. But it was a law that then boys need to learn to write. but girls were not, were specifically not taught to write. Because actually it was important as a girl to learn submission. And in the same way that it's illegal for slaves to learn to write, right? Like if you learn how to write, you could forge a pass. You could do all kinds of things if you knew how to write. For those who are supposed to submit and defer, writing is quite a dangerous thing.
You quote an essayist who laments, "I am one of those unfortunate tradesmen who are plagued with a reading wife. My wife does hardly one earthly thing but read, read, and read."
Yeah, and you think about, I mean, one of the wonderful things, you know, Franklin's so celebrated for his autobiography, which is the story of how he basically read his way out of poverty, right? Like they're born into a very poor family in Boston, and, you know, he's 6 years older than she is, and he becomes an avid reader, and then he's apprenticed as a printer to his brother, where he can read all the books in the printing house. He trades books with some other kid in town who's also a printer's apprentice. He runs away to Philadelphia. He becomes a printer here. He opens up the library. Franklin rises through reading. And Jane doesn't actually have that capacity early on in girlhood. She can really only read the books that are in her father's library, which are just pious, devotional sermons. But then over the course of that long correspondence with Franklin, she begs him for books, and he sends her books. I mean, she amasses this actually huge library over the course of her very long life and reads, you know, every 18th century work that you would want to read if you could go back to the 18th century and read Swift as he was being published, and Addison and Steele, and read 18th century political philosophy. She really loved politics. She loved to read books about politics. She read everything that Franklin wrote. I mean, even if you only read what Franklin wrote, you would have read a great deal in the 18th century.
And yet she was prepared for, as you say, a life of confinement, but confinement with books, right?
Yeah. I mean, that you can see that it's her tether to the outside world, and it's in a way her salvation. And she comes to, although she has a very different set of ideas about how the world works and order in the world, really quite late in her life, and after the American Revolution, she's raised her children, her grandchildren, and she's also had to raise her great grandchildren because her daughters and granddaughters keep dying in childbirth, so she has to raise children her whole life. But when she's a very old woman, she finally actually has the leisure to read as much as she wants.
Wow.
And it's just this sort of like Grandma Moses kind of explosion thing, or something. She's writing these letters to her brother. Well, I read this, and here's what I think of that, and here's what I think of this, and here's what, you know. Finally, this woman who's been, you know, sort of quiet and hushed and muffled her whole life just blossoms.
Hence the subtitle of your book, The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation with Jill Lepore. And we are talking about Ben Franklin's little sister, and her book, our guest book, is called Book of Ages. Any questions or comments you might have about Jane Franklin and her brother, I guess, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Alzheimer's disease is the sixth leading cause of death in the U.S. Alzheimer's is not curable, but prescription medications can sometimes help to maintain the quality of life for longer periods. Keystone Clinical Studies of Norristown is conducting a research study to test a new investigational medication for patients with a diagnosis of mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. 610-277-8073. 610-277-8073 or keystoneclinicalstudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, at a time when many cities around the world are encouraging people to ride bikes, Calcutta, India wants to ban them on many of its streets during the day. Police say there's simply not enough room on Calcutta's crowded streets for so many bikes and other non-motorized vehicles. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Kimmel Center supports WHYY and presents Orquesta Buena Vista Social Club Wednesday, October 9th at the Merriam Theater. Seemingly emerging from nowhere in the mid-1990s, the Buena Vista Social Club established itself as an international ambassador for Cuban music, transcending musical styles, fads, and fashion. the group has reunited to tour as the 13-piece Orquesta Buena Vista Social Club, featuring several alumni of the original album and film. Tickets at KimmelCenter.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Jill Lepore. She's a history professor at Harvard University, a staff writer at The New Yorker. Chances are you have read some of her pieces. And she has a new book called Book of Ages, The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin. Again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Your book is called Book of Ages, which is really based on a small book that she kept about the sort of birth and death of her 12 children.
Yeah, you know, Franklin, again, so famous for the autobiography, writes the story of his life rising from rags to riches. And I thought, when I found out that there was this little sort of, it was described as a, you know, in a catalog as a journal kept by Jane Franklin Meekham, and I went into the archives to see it. And it's this tiny, tiny little slip of a thing, like a little patch
couple
of
pages,
burlap.
Right?
It's four sheets of foolscap that she's folded and stitched together with this quite coarse thread. And then on the first page, she's really ornate, in this ornate hand, Book of Ages. This is like kind of chilling phrase. You know, what is a Book of Ages? I like kept looking. What does that even mean? It isn't actually used very often in the 18th century. It actually means a book of the dead. But she... And it starts, you know, Jane Franklin born March 27, 1712. Like an autobiography would start. Like you're something full of just expectation and thrill. Like, wow, Jane Franklin wrote an autobiography. That's going to be so great to sort of look at against Franklin's story of his life. And then, you know, you read down, and it's actually a chronicle of the births and deaths of her 12 children with prayers that she could be guided by God to endure their loss.
In fact, she writes, this is, I guess, her first child, Josiah Meekham, their first born on Wednesday, June the 4th, 1729. And below this, then she writes, and died May the 18th, 1730, meaning he didn't live to his first year.
Yeah, and she's, you know, the 17-year-old girl. And this is the most commonplace and ordinary of experiences. And I spent a lot of time trying to think about how a young woman would grieve such a loss. And it's sort of devastating to look to see that the Puritan ministers of the time, their commandment is, do not weep. Weep not. Weep not. There should be no words at the graveside. Jane wouldn't have been able to afford a gravestone. These are children that would just be, you know, put underground, and she would have a hard time even finding the spot again. They might mark it with a stick. She was very poor. And what does she – she certainly has no portraits of them. I mean, all the things that might comfort us. Even just the kind of ghost of, like, people now have video recordings of their children. You know,
sure.
She, nothing. Like the evanescence, the frailty, the sense of mortality. And, you know, she has her faith. She's a deeply devout person. But she keeps this little book, not because she wants to celebrate the story of her own life and be a model for other people, the way friends, because she needs a place to keep a record that these souls ever lived, that these children ever were alive. This is just an archive. It's like a baby book without the pictures, and it's really it's like a funeral record. It has all these other valences that we use other forms for, but it just struck me as so powerful allegorically, because Franklin always wrote about his life as an allegory, right? Like, I ran away from home and I rebelled from tyranny, and now I'm a free man, and America is just like me. We ran away from Britain and we rebelled from their tyranny, and now we're a free nation, and Franklin is America, and there's this kind of soaring triumph to it all. And Jane's story is just, I am a poor woman, and this is what life is like. It is suffering and loss and reconciliation with your God.
But that's also America. And certainly
that is
the
also
America of that time. I mean, most people were probably poor like Jane.
She is, you know, her life is actually far more representative than his. I mean, that's what's extraordinary from everything about Franklin's life. People did not rise from poverty to wealth in the 18th century. It's only because Franklin because it's so unusual that he becomes so celebrated for doing that. He's the only one of the founding fathers that does that, right? Like, these other guys are all, you know, slave owners from the South, or, you know, the sons of wealthy Boston merchants or Philadelphia merchants. Franklin's a completely different character altogether.
Do you think her Book of Ages was her sort of memorial then to her children, or became a memorial to her children, even looking maybe at the writing and just the way it looked? I know you've held this book, right?
Yeah. It's quite moving to hold it in your hands because it's so humble and it's so full of agony. The worst part for me was I got to a page in 1767, so she has decades left to live, right. And her husband has died, and one of her daughters dies in childbirth, and then two of her grandchildren that Jane's taking care of die of the same illness, and then her favorite daughter, whom she sent off to Nantucket where she thinks she might get well, dies, and she writes in her Book of Ages, you know, she quotes from the Book of Job, "What have I more?" And then she just begs God, you know, "May I not be so rebellious as to rebel against God?" And then she puts down her pen. The rest of the book is empty. It's blank. They're blank pages. And so sitting in this archive, like, I finally come across this diary kept by this 18th century woman who's going to reveal all to me. And she reveals nothing but her inability to even document her pain.
Like, but doesn't that reveal something?
That does, right. So that's the sort of like trying to sort of listen to the silence. Like, that's thinking about the asymmetry. Like, what does it mean that Franklin could go on for pages about his great triumphant rise? And she could not, she made this little archive a kind of mourning memento to her children. And the pain of it was actually too much to bear to even write in any longer. So she puts that away. She writes a letter to her brother. And she says, you know, "Sorrows roll upon me like the waves upon the sea."
Do we know why? You think she was pregnant, and perhaps that's why she married Edward Meekham. He did end up in debtor's prison. I guess it wasn't that hard, perhaps, to end up in debtor's prison at that time. Was he just a sort of an irresponsible husband, or was he a dreamer? Do we know? I know that she never really referenced him in her letters to Franklin.
Yeah, we don't know. I mean, and there's just this kind of funny little clue. So he was a saddler. He made saddles. And, you know, horses tack. And there's a point fairly early on in their marriage where Franklin writes, it says, "Brother Meekham hasn't sent me the collar that I requested yet," like a horse's collar, you know, that he's... It's so clear, like, he does not need to go to Boston to get a horse's collar. He's trying to throw some business at Jane's husband, and the guy can't even deliver that. Like,
wow.
I mean, so whatever is wrong with him, maybe he's just... whether it's incapacity or lack of industry, it's impossible to know. It does seem to be something congenital, because it's really her sons are often like thrown into bed, and there seems to be. I spent a lot of time like talking to physicians and trying to figure out the kind of medical records that survive as well. I think that the family suffered from tuberculosis, and there are some forms of tuberculosis that can contribute to existing dementia. So I don't know.
Yeah.
But you know anything about Franklin saying, like, early, the industry begets wealth, and his all of his poor Richard aphorisms, like, all you need to do is work hard, early to bed, early to rise, which makes a man wealthy. And Jane's like, actually, no. industry doesn't always, like, there are some people for whom industry does not lead to wealth. And it's unfortunate. And Franklin really kind of has to reckon with that.
And it makes you wonder whether debtor's prison was filled with people who were mentally unstable or mentally ill. I mean, what would you do with someone at that time, especially if they were poor?
Yeah. And I mean, that's one of the things that Franklin is contributing in the 18th century, or thinking about what forms of institutions, publicly funded institutions like hospitals.
Right.
Can be developed, or, you know, the fire department, the hospital, the library, all these tremendous public institutions that are publicly funded that Franklin is instrumental in founding, because he recognizes the role that institutions can play. I mean, it's one of the things that makes me just kind of crazy about thinking about how Franklin is always invoked by the far right as the kind of founding father of capitalism and free enterprise, because nothing could be further from the truth. Like, Franklin is actually the founding father of publicly funded public institutions for the betterment of those who are born in disadvantaged situations. And a lot of that comes from his own life, and a lot of it comes from his close relationship with Jane, which is among the reasons why we really need to think about her life.
And again, that's Jill Lepore, our guest today on Radio Times. The book we're talking about is titled Book of Ages, and it's subtitled The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin. She was Benjamin Franklin's sister, the youngest, I guess, of 17.
Yeah.
They had a very close relationship, corresponded for decades. And our guest teaches history at Harvard University, and she's a staff writer for The New Yorker. Any questions or comments that you might have, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or message us on our Facebook page, or if that weren't enough, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. she is very resourceful. I mean, she, you know, she takes in works, laundry and sewing. She takes in boarders. I guess when she becomes a widow, she needs to make money to support the family, brings in boarders, but not just any boarders. I mean, these are people, political people that are living in her house.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting to think about what you would do if you were an 18th century married woman married to someone who really couldn't work. Like, her husband basically at a certain point, well after they've had their 12 children, can no longer work. Right. Like, married women cannot own property. They cannot earn wages. Like, legally, they do not exist, right? You are a covered woman. You're covered by the man. Like, she's very, very little you can do this. So you see in newspapers, in the back of the newspapers in the 18th century, you always see women selling their breast milk.
Oh, wow.
Because it's a thing you can do. And you think about what that means. Like,
first, you're having babies all the time.
You're having babies. You always have milk. And you're often depriving your own children of milk in order to sell milk. So it's a very hard, very, very hard economic times in the 18th century. One of the reasons that the revolution comes about is people are really, the working class are really suffering. And Jane, one of the few things she can do is take in boarders. And it happens that she's in Boston, and probably through Franklin and his own connections and ties and his many correspondents in Boston, she ends up taking boarders who are mostly members of the Massachusetts Assembly.
Wow.
So these are these guys, you know, sort of Sam Adams, John kind of guys who are debating what to do about the Stamp Act and what to do about the Townsend Acts and what to do about the Tea Act, and they're living in her house. And so Franklin, she then becomes a really kind of valuable correspondent for Franklin in a completely different way, because she can say, well, I've been hearing a very interesting conversation at dinner this evening.
And would she correspond that
yeah,
way?
Yeah. I mean, she would say, and I've listened a lot. And she didn't, she was quite discreet. And Franklin had clearly spoken to her about discretion, because there was a lot of political intrigue. A lot of what was going on was vaguely treasonous, and then later, you know, literally treasonous. And so Franklin had to be very protective of what anybody could put in the mail in a letter to him. So there's a lot of their corners for, like, you have been too free with me. so you
kind of code word.
Yeah. But again, like, she's not only reading, you know, Swift or, you know, 18th century political thinkers. She's listening to these debates in her very house.
She says, I do not pretend to write about politics, she once wrote her brother. You write, though I love to hear them. Then you say she did more than listen.
She does do more than listen, because she has her own ideas. You know, one of my favorite moments is when Franklin is, she comes to Philadelphia for the American Revolution, because Boston's been, you know, taken over by the British. And Franklin rides up to Cambridge, where Washington is headquartered, with a carriage to rescue Jane and bring her back to Philadelphia. And it's like the happiest time for her life. She's like, well, you know, the world is going to hell in a handbasket.
But
I have this, like, really long carriage ride with my brother, whom I haven't seen in years, and I adore him. And they have this, like, incredibly fun long ride. And then she lives with him while he's, you know, meeting with the Continental Congress. So, you know, just right down the street, and having Tom Paine over for dinner. You know, she's listening. The problem is, of course, when people live in the same house together, what happens? They don't write letters to one another anymore. So,
but it's clear
there's a bit of a veil over that little period. But it's clear she's in the middle of everything. She couldn't be more in the middle of everything. But my favorite sort of piece of their political exchange is when she's back in Boston after the war. He buys her a house in the North End. And when Franklin's in Philadelphia for the Continental Constitutional Convention, you know, they're sequestered. They're not allowed to write letters during the whole time. And it's, you know, it's from May to September in 1787. And, you know, the last letter Franklin writes before he's sequestered is to Jane. And the first letter he writes when he gets out is to Jane. And she writes him a letter right before he's going into the Constitutional Convention. And she says, I just have one thing that I want you gentlemen in Philadelphia to think about. No guns.
Oh, wow.
No guns. We should all, you know, beat our swords into plowshares. Like, there's just, she's really suffered during the war, the actual act of war. The violence on the streets in Boston, the British soldiers just attacking people. She lost a son who fought in the Battle of Bunker Hill. She just wants the members of the Constitutional Convention to think about guns.
It's interesting, you mentioned Abigail Adams. I mean, it's interesting to think about Jane Franklin's correspondence with her brother and Abigail and John Adams' correspondence with each other. I mean, both, I guess, what each got from each other, but also how different they were, obviously.
Yeah, they're really different. I mean, Abigail Adams is, again, like, incredibly well-educated and in a traditional and learned sense. Jane is a hard-scrabble, self-taught, rebellious, woman living in very different circumstances than Abigail Adams. They would not have met.
Right.
Although John Adams is the one who after everybody flees Boston in 1775, he's the one who gets a message to Franklin that his sister has survived and that she's hiding in Rhode Island. So they have they're in a world of conversation in some small way. But Abigail meets John on the page as an equal because he accepted that from her. I mean, that was part of their affection and their relationship. She's just not representative in that way. Mm-hmm. Jane speaks from a completely different social position. And
more deferential.
She's more deferential to him all through their lives until the very end when she comes into her own as a much older woman. Mm-hmm. And then, and also in the wake of the revolution, really transforms her. I mean, you see the power of a shifting conversation in the whole of the Western world about the relationship between their people and their rulers. And you see that is the roots of all struggles for equality, right? Like, not all of them are realized right away, but you see how much that shapes what she is willing to say to her brother.
Feels more like an equal to her brother who helped to create this country.
Yeah. I mean, she speaks her mind in a wholly different way.
Hmm. She does correspond with Franklin's wife, right? I mean, it seems like they have a close connection,
yeah,
or correspondence.
Yeah. And Franklin has married someone who's quite a bit like his sister in the same sense. She's not educated at all. She comes from a very humble background. Franklin had, you know, trifled with many fancier ladies, but he was more comfortable with women who were very poorly educated in a certain way, I think. And Jane becomes quite close to Deborah, and she stays with her, obviously, when she comes to Philadelphia. And they have this kind of hilarious course. Like, 18th century letters are they come across as very mannered to us. Like, they're all full of these, like, florid phrases. And they're just, I mean, think about what, you know, stuff that you think of 18th century stuff that, like, you know, John Adams would say. It sounds...
I can hear it.
So mannered. And women's writing is a little annoying because it's all like, oh, I'm so not worthy to write, and I have no thought, I should not be bearing a pen, but should be bearing a needle in my paw, and whatever. It's annoying. But Jane actually writes quite differently when she writes to Deborah, who's also equally uneducated, and she writes pretty much exactly like she speaks, because she doesn't actually know how to write a polite letter. She's not been trained to do that. So when she writes to Benjamin, she has to try to pass it off, and she can't do it very well, and it gets a little clumsy. When she writes to Deborah, she's like, well, and another thing, Cousin Davies is about to lie in, and I think she's so big she will have two. You know, there's this
good gossipy,
gossip,
right?
And it's just fresh, and it's raw, and it's vital. And when she's mourning, it's really there. And it's a wholly different voice. Yeah.
We're almost up at a break here, but I mean, you do include many of her writings in here, and it is a struggle. I mean, I have to say, it is a struggle to read. She doesn't use punctuation. Of course, the spelling is just all over the place, but it's a struggle to
it is.
Decipher what she's trying to say.
It is. But it's like a jigsaw puzzle or a crossword. It's fun in that way, too.
And that's Jill Lepore, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about Jane Franklin, Benjamin Franklin's little sister. And Jill Lepore is a history professor at Harvard University, a staff writer at The New Yorker. And her new book is called Book of Ages, The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin. And as we have been talking about, we all seem to know a lot about Benjamin Franklin. But her life, of course, very important to the understanding of this country, what life was like for poor people and for women during that time as well. Give us a call. Questions, comments, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Calico celebrates their new store for designer fabrics and furnishings in Glen Eagle Square on Route 202 in Glen Mills. 3 days of grand opening events begin October 3rd with designer Tom Felicia at 6 p.m. Learn more at calicocorners.com.
Are you a woman age 40 to 65? Are you worried about weight gain, heart health, or symptoms of menopause? Drexel University is offering a research program designed to help midlife women have a healthier lifestyle. Through group meetings with other women, this program is designed to help women increase exercise, improve eating habits, and manage stress and mood. More information at 215-553-7110 or email nextsteps@drexel.edu. Drexel supports WHYY.
Former CIA agent Valerie Plame on Iran.
It's kind of outrageous that in 30 years we have not had any sort of official dialogue between the United States and Iran.
In from the cold to talk about her new novel Blowback and Syria, and Edward Snowden, a CIA agent anxious to write fiction. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Wheaton Arts in Millville, New Jersey, presents the Festival of Fine Craft, Saturday and Sunday, October 5th and 6th, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. both days. 130 juried artists and more. Details online at wheatonarts.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Jill Lepore about her book called Book of Ages, A Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin. We, of course, know quite a bit about her brother Benjamin Franklin, but what about his little sister Jane? Their lives could not have been more different. They had a close relationship, wrote letters to each other for most of their adult lives, and affectionately called each other Benny and Jenny. Our guest, Jill Lepore, has pieced together Jane Franklin's story in her new book, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So they corresponded with each other for decades. I mean, as you said, there's kind of this hole in the beginning of her life, but they corresponded back and forth. And it seems that she does complain quite a bit about, you never write to me.
Yeah.
Where are you? What are you doing?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, Franklin obviously has a lot going on in his life. And you get a sense of how much she's leaning on that correspondence as a kind of lifeline and yeah. as a connection to a broader world. But you also see, too, for him, how much it means to have that correspondence with her. I mean, I don't know if you, like, I'm the person in my family who ran away. You know, like, I'm the person who left and left everybody behind. You know, everybody stayed in town and lived near
You're
home.
You're like Franklin.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm not like Franklin in the sense that I'm not a genius, but you know, but if you're the person who ran away, you actually kind of need the people that you left behind to sort of stay there. Like, it's psychologically, you kind of need them to be who they were. You sort of define yourself against that your whole life, and you love them for being who they were, but you also, it would freak you out if they kind of moved into your world. Like, it would just be, it would be odd. And Franklin has that with Jane. Like, there's this moment where, you know, one of the things that he was running away from was religion. He was running away from Puritanism. He didn't want to be part of Puritan Boston. He didn't believe what his parents believed. And Philadelphia was more cosmopolitan. I mean, first he went to London. But, you know, he had a very different set of ideas about God. And he couldn't have borne living in Boston. Jane is quite devout her whole life. And Franklin, although they fight about that often, he needs her to be that way because it's kind of an anchor for him. It lets his ship go wherever it needs to go. If she's that anchor back moored in the off the docks in Boston. And there's this moment where I was talking about in her little Book of Ages where she keeps track of the births and deaths of her children, where she begins to question her faith. You know, so there's been so many deaths, and she quotes Job, and you know, she begins to think that her core belief, which is that everything that happens is fated by God, it's providential rule, she begins to think that might not be true. She begins to think that, you know, maybe actually something else is going on. Actually, maybe politics is what's causing her children to die in poverty and misery and sickness. It's things that men in power do, not necessarily what God does. And Franklin kind of can't abide that. Like, on the one hand, he believes that, but on the other hand, he needs her to be different. He needs that. So the correspondence is precious to both of them, but in a quite different way.
Is there any way to know if she influenced the revolution or his thinking about the revolution? I mean, certainly she was his tie to probably how most people were living in the colonies at the time. Mm-hmm. But is there any way to know that her life experience helped him think about?
I think that would be difficult to know because, for instance, in his autobiography, he never mentions her. Right? Franklin is quite adept at making his own myth. That's what the whole point of writing the story of his life is. Like, I'm going to tell this story in such a way that it will be an allegory and it will help young tradesmen to figure out how to rise to become gentlemen, and it will help us think about what political struggle is for. And for that myth to work, he needs to make himself. He needs to be a self-made man. This can't be, and I thought so much because I learned from this person or learned from that person. It has to be, his story is, I squirreled myself away with my candle and read all night long, and I thought and I thought, and I taught myself how to write, and then I thought and I thought, and I thought it would be a great idea to have a post office, and then I thought and I thought, and it would be a great idea to have a fire department, and then I thought and I thought, and I thought, electricity comes in negative and positive. You know, that the story works. It's all about the being the author of your own life, right? Jane believed God was the author of everyone's life, and he believed differently. And in order to sort of hammer that point home, he needs to be an island in that way. So that means that if she did influence him or his wife or any other experience he had, he erases that. Mm.
Does that mean that, I mean, this is broadly speaking, of course, that and perhaps more about the past than the present, that the men end up in the history books and the women become Jane Austen novels?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that happens in the 18th century. Fiction, the novel, is invented in the 18th century, and it is actually invented by people who say, you know what the problem with history is? It can't actually contain the lives of ordinary people because they're not documented. And history is becoming more empirically minded, like people are actually beginning to sort of, you know, talk about their sources and need to have documentary evidence to make a certain claim. History, as we know, is sort of born in the 18th century too, but the two kind of cleave, and it becomes like history is about men. And fiction is about women. And it just sort of works that way. And the problem, you know, with someone like Jane is there are a lot of novels about people written, a lot of 18th century novels written about someone like Jane who was seduced at the age of 15, but they all die. Like the 18th century heroine who's seduced at the age of 15 must die. Does not go on to, you know, have 12 children and then raise grandchildren, then raise great-grandchildren. Like that's not an 18th century, there is no 18th century novel that tells that story.
Which is why this is not a novel.
Right.
Okay, fair enough. Let me get to, it looks like Rick from Wilmington to join us. Rick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. This is maybe a little off topic. It's more of a kind of a personal question for the author. You teach at Harvard, so you're probably in Cambridge, which is where Jane lived. Do you ever go to any of the sites where she lived and try and find in the addresses in which she lived and see if there's, obviously there's not going to be anything left from an 18th century Boston on some street, you know, back street or something, but just curious.
Yeah, thanks for the call.
It's actually a great question because it's a good story here. So the house where Jane and Benjamin grew up is no longer there. There's a historical marker there. But the house that Jane died in is in the North End. And it's this little brick house built in 1712. She died there in 1793. And we know who built it because it's the brick mason who built the old North Church.
Oh, wow.
And she writes about it because Franklin buys it for her and she adores it. And she, you know, she paints the door one day and she writes Franklin a letter saying, I painted the door because I wouldn't want anybody to be ashamed of my house if they came looking for Dr. Franklin's sister. It's a huge, it's very important to her, this little house. It happened that after Henry Wadsworth Longfellow wrote his poem about Paul Revere's ride, the city of Boston wanted to put a new plaza behind Old North Church and an equestrian statue of Revere as if he's like riding from the Old North Church, you know, with his message. And Jane's little house there, this little 18th century brick house that had been known as Benjamin Franklin's sister's house for years and years and years, was in the way of the line of sight between Old North Church, which is a great Boston landmark, and this new equestrian statue that was being put in. So in 1939, the city of Boston demolished her house. And it's remarkable that such a thing happened, but it's really just another sort of allegory for what happens to ordinary people's lives. Like, she got in the way of a statue about a poem, about a myth. Like, Paul Revere's ride is, like, the historical record of what Paul Revere did has nothing to do with Longfellow's poem. Like, Jane's obituary in the Boston newspaper was longer than Paul Revere's obituary. Like, it's just, Paul Revere's not important at the time. But he's important to this sort of founding father myth in the 20th century. And it actually so devastated this great Franklin scholar and biographer, Carl Van Doren, in 1939 that he decided he would dedicate the rest of his life to finding Jane Franklin's papers because he was so upset about her house being knocked down. Like, it just seems so wrong to him. So Carl Van Doren is pretty much the guy who collected the letters that do survive for the American Philosophical Society here in Philadelphia, which is where the letters are chiefly housed.
Wow. Do you feel as a historian, and perhaps even looking at this book and some of your other books as well, is that your job is to sort of demythologize our history? I mean, there's so much myth-making that goes into history-making.
Sure, and a lot of that myth-making is great. I mean,
like,
you know, we live in a world of fables, and fables have a place. And, you know, I have young kids, and I know what they learn in third grade about the American Revolution is not what I would teach to my Harvard freshmen.
Right.
But it's important learning, and it's what they do, and they need to have a story to tell and a way to understand it.
That doesn't mean that grown-ups can't look at something far more complex and be asked to think harder. Because I do think for grown-ups, fables can be quite dangerous. Oh, yeah. And I think that a lot of our, you know, heritage tourism about the founding fathers, you know, much of it is very beautiful and wonderful and delightful, you know, the sort of costumed reenactors and whatnot. But much of it, I think, perpetuates a set of ideas that really do continue the act of historical erasure. So that we suddenly think, you know, inequality is a novelty, or, you know, there really hasn't been a question of problems involving poverty since, you know, until the 1960s and the war on poverty, and then suddenly, or like, I don't know, people just have a kind of myopia. And one of the things I try to do in writing about both Benjamin and Jane mm-hmm. is thinking, you know, about Franklin's own, you know, one of his greatest inventions about the bifocal. Like, how can we see both Jane and Benjamin with the same pair of spectacles? How can we look at the American past and both see, you know, the greatness of someone like Franklin and his striking and original and truly fantastic contributions to ideas and politics, but also the ordinary experience, and know that those two things, you can't actually bring anything into focus without seeing both at the same time.
Mm. You had an interesting piece in The New Yorker. I mean, it was about Jane Franklin, but also about your mother. It's about a little bit about your childhood growing up as well. And it seemed your mother was the person who kept saying, you've got to write this book. You've got to write this book.
Yeah. My mother, you know, who had been an artist before she got married and then had four kids and, you know, had a certain life of a certain kind of confinement. I mean, not an unhappy life at all. Yeah. But there are a lot of women I know of my generation and women of other generations who've really been kind of pushed out into the world by their mothers, who sort of insisted, you know, I had a lovely life, but actually you have different kind of opportunities. So why don't you, you know, go do some things?
It would be good if you would do something. That was you, right?
And for my, you know, for my mom, like, I was the one in my family sort of pushed out. I mean, I ran away, but I was also a little pushed out. And, you know, I'm a very domestic person. I'm a sort of stay at home, want to be home with my kids all the time. And it's a struggle to go out into the world and, you know, spend time doing a radio show when I'm home with my kids. But, like, I take very seriously my mother's admonition that, you know, Jane said to her children all the time, do the right thing with spirit. It's one of her, you know, great adages. I think about my mother's time, just the kind of thing my mother would say. Like, look, we need to know this story. Go out and do it. You know, stop. You don't get to sit at home and, you know, watch TV with your kids when you have something to say that actually matters in the world.
And you did that willingly? Because coming from a parent, you know, it can be a loaded mission.
Yeah. Well,
it took me
a long time, didn't it?
But do you identify with Jane Franklin at all?
I mean, she
not to make too much.
I do and I don't. I mean, I identify with both of them. My mother, I think, identified with Jane in many ways. I certainly thought a lot about, you know, when I had three children fairly quickly and spending an enormous amount of time doing laundry and thinking about having 12 children and not having a washing machine. I mean, there are things that when you are dealing with the kind of the daily sense and the sudden recognition that everything you do is for others, right? That's the experience of being a parent of young children immediately. Like, we have this very different notion of young adulthood until some. And then thinking about that was her entire life. Like, there was no moment in her life when she wasn't taking care of people. That, you know, I took care of, you know, my children, I took care of my parents. But there was a kind of, there were breaks from that. And, like, the way our lives are kind of segmented out, there are breaks from that. That was the entire experience of a person like this. So how can we think about a life of the mind?
She says at one point, writing to her brother, I write among so much noise and confusion that if I had anything of consequence, I could not recollect it. And I have to say, who doesn't connect with that at some point in your life where you just feel like, ah,
yeah. Well, it's fascinating. I was giving a talk at a college in New England last year, and just lovely little talk about Jane. And this wonderful woman came up. I think she was a chemist, and she was a junior professor, and she had two young children. And she said, your talk is just a revelation to me. It's like a history of the work-life balance. and I thought that was so interesting because here's this, you know, exceedingly well-educated, you know, PhD-holding chemist who is identifying with Jane, this poor woman in the 18th century with 12 children who barely knew how to write. And that actually is both immensely moving in terms of our capacity as humans for empathy and to reach across time and space to understand people's lives, the kind of humanistic sensibility, but also deeply sad in terms of the utter lack of resolution in any sense of how we understand the relationship between taking care of others and leading a life of the mind. That the pain of Jane, that she couldn't write a letter because there's too much tumult in her house, and she couldn't find the pen because it was under the cushion, or, you know, there are all these hilarious things in her life that we all kind of get. That both kind of comforts me and makes me deeply sad.
And at the same time, I mean, she lived almost, I forget how old she was, but she certainly lived a very long life through most of the 18th century. So she lived in such an extraordinary time when you think about it.
Yeah, and these people, 18th century Enlightenment philosophers always do these little thought experiments. Like, what if you had a boy child and a girl child and they were twins and they were born together, and then, you know, you educated him the way you educate a boy and educated her the way you educate a girl. What would their fate of their lives? And then people would do these little, you know, kind of experiments. Well, you actually don't need to do an
experiment.
You don't need to do an experiment. Like, you know, Jane and Benjamin Franklin lived the entirety of the 19th of the 18th century, and they were that experiment. I mean, like, it's not an experiment; it's an actual life, a pair of lives that you can watch direct through.
Having written this book, and obviously it's taken up so much, or some of a certain good portion of your life. I mean, do you miss her? Do you still feel like she's with you, Jane Franklin?
I miss my mother.
Oh, you miss your mother.
I miss my mother. I still have this. Someone told me that I would have this, and it turns out to be true. Whenever anything happens that's exciting, I pick up the phone and I start calling my mom.
Yeah.
Like, and there's a little bit of a loss of that when the character you've been writing about, but I never could call Jane. Like, I could listen to her. She has a voice in my head, but I couldn't tell her anything.
Yeah.
And I had that thing with my mother as the kid who kind of ran away, the one who needs to be entertaining and send the letter back that Franklin would send to Jane. You know, the world is so interesting, let me tell you about it, that someone needs, and I don't have someone to give that to.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, Jill Lepore. Thank you
so much
for joining us today on Radio Times. And again, Jill Lepore has been our guest. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker. She's a history professor at Harvard University, and she's got a brand new book. It's called Book of Ages, and it's subtitled The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin. Jane Franklin, the sister of Benjamin Franklin. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.